We're joined at the Roadhouse by Mary Roach. She's on the phone from Oakland, California. Mary is an American author. She writes popular science and all kinds of icky yucky things about the human body and science. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Mary.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. I have looked through your books, and I've looked at some of the other things that you've written, and you have a very interesting take on science in general and the human body in particular. What was it that made you decide to go that direction with your writing?
Well, it kind of happened randomly. I was I wrote for Salon.com, which was way back in 1999, a very exciting thing, an online magazine. Woo!
Yes, the beginning of the internet.
The beginnings of the whole online phenomena, particularly in journalism. And I wrote a column. It was kind of a free-for-all. It was a reported column with some humor, and it was generally related to the human body and health, medicine, but I tend to go off to the fringes of whatever subject area I'm given, and that's where I went. And the column was a terrific amount of fun. I reported on things like I was invited to go along bowling with a group of amputees who have a really good attitude.
Yeah.
They were called Stumps R Us. And they invited me to come along to go bowling. And these guys, I'm telling you, they had you can get a prosthetic attachment specifically for bowling with a little, you put this, a little thing that sticks out into the holes of the bowling ball, and you move your shoulder, and then it releases it. And these guys were just, they were bowling strikes and spares, and just, you know, I'm with the filled-in gutter on the side.
Right.
So,
but
anyway,
still having a good time.
Still having a good time, yeah. So this column was a lot of fun to do, and some agent called me and said, hey, you know, you should do a book proposal. And so I looked at which columns got really good hit rates, and there were a couple that had to do with cadaver research. And so based on the fact that people seemed to find this interesting, I went ahead and wrote a book proposal and ended up writing this book, Stiff, about post-mortem careers, interesting things you can do as a dead person. And this is where things got rolling, and I just have stayed in that world. I don't have a science background. I have a BA in psychology. So I'm really not particularly well equipped to do what I do, but so what?
Well, but you do have a very disarming voice with subjects that can be somewhat uncomfortable, not the least of which is dead bodies. And
right.
I actually was so impressed at your ability to maintain the line between cringingly yucky and hilariously gross in all of your books, but Stiff in particular had some pretty funny little areas.
Yeah, that was a line that I wasn't sure I was managing, and it was, I didn't show this book to anybody before I sent it to my editor, so I was a tremendous amount of terror involved in putting this book out, because I thought, well, if I show it to anybody, another writer, say, or some editor-type person, and they say, well, you know, this whole humor and cadaver mixture is not working, it's really offensive, it's immature, I would have said, oh, my God, you're right. Let's take it all out. But so I didn't show it to anyone, and my editor left it all in. And so we put this book out, and I just had fingers crossed that the balance was okay, and it wasn't, because the last thing I wanted to do with that book was alienate anybody who had just lost someone or who had any kind of issues with death. And strangely, the book, sometimes I hear from people that it was a comforting thing to read because it kind of just faced being dead head on as part of life and kind of demystified things. And I didn't really expect that to be an effect of the book, but I'm always glad to hear that.
Well, you know, that's a theme through all of your books, is that it takes things, again, that are kind of uncomfortable and puts them in scientific terms. They're not, you're not playing it for a joke, and you're not playing it for gross, but, you know, face it, there's some funny stuff here and there, and you might as well laugh a little bit while you can, but having information and having facts, power is knowledge, and knowledge is power,
yeah.
So it works great. But there is a lot of fodder there.
Well, I like taboo subjects, partly because it's just really interesting. It's fascinating material that a lot of other people shy away from. So I'm kind of like the bottom feeder in the aquarium. You know, the stuff that falls to the bottom that nobody else wants to deal with, I guess. I'm like, I'll do it.
But that is how evolution works now, isn't it? You know, everybody finds a niche that's unexploited.
Yeah, exactly right. When I was a kid, I had an aquarium, and I had this, I think it was a loach, a slime loach or something. It was this fish that would go around the bottom and take the stuff that dropped down, and that was the fattest, healthiest fish in my aquarium, which might have had to do partly with my skills as an aquarium keeper, but I kind of identify with the slime loach.
So do you have a specific little anecdote from one of your earlier books or a couple of your earlier books that sticks with you and makes you giggle a little bit to this day?
Here's something that made me, that amused me to no end. When you become an astronaut, this is a book about the physical, psychological, surreal challenges of living in a place that has no gravity, no air, all of the things that you as a human being need to thrive. It's not there. People are up there, though. It's a very surreal scenario. So this is the topic of that book. And one of the things I learned at Johnson Space Center is that astronauts are both the most highly qualified, best trained, intelligent people, straight A's, best GPA. At the same time, once you become an astronaut, you're sent back to kindergarten. You have to relearn how to move across a room, how to eat your food, how to go to the bathroom. They have actually a man at Johnson Space Center who's the potty trainer of the astronauts. This is a man and it's a serious thing. Because just take the example, and this is biology. I don't want to gross people out
no,
here.
No, this
but
is good. This is good.
The human bladder, okay. Nobody thought about this in the beginnings of the space program. This is an organ that depends on gravity because the fluid builds up on the floor of the organ. It's a little, it's like a bag filling up. And at a certain point, stretch receptors are triggered that tell you it's time to find a toilet. Go to the bathroom. Empty your bladder. Well, in zero gravity, the liquid doesn't build up on the bottom of the bag. It sticks it clings by surface tension all around the perimeter of this bag, this spherical shaped bag, and so you have much longer period of time before you activate the stretch receptors, so much so that the bladder can be overfull and you can have difficulty beginning the flow, as
right.
they say. So, the astronauts are told, go to the bathroom every few hours, even though you don't feel it. It's like, a parent telling a child, before we begin the trip, do you need to go to the bathroom? and so these, these very high achieving, motivated, brave, strong Americans, they're really starting at the beginning, and I just found that fascinating.
Well, the other kindergarten thing, you learned everything you needed to know in kindergarten was just learning how to get along with others. When you think about space travel, in the past, the Gemini, the Apollo missions, they were out there for a few days, maybe a week, a little longer. If you're talking about going to Mars, for example, you're looking at, 500 days to do a Mars mission?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to be without any of the creature comforts of home. You're going to be out in space, and you're going to be locked in a very small place with a small number of people and not a lot of support or any other way to deal with it. And I thought that section of the book was absolutely fascinating to me. Some of the things that I'd never really thought about that you could have get on your nerves or have get on other people's nerves.
Oh, yeah. And then that is enough of an issue that it's completely changed the qualifications, the things that NASA looks for in an astronaut in terms of psychology and personality. In the old days, the right stuff was independent, brave, aggressive, self-starter, someone like John Glenn or the guys in The Right Stuff that was fighter pilot type dudes.
Yeah, right.
And that's now with longer missions, with bigger crews, that's now, and often cross-cultural crews, that's become the absolute wrong stuff. So NASA now, some of the qualifications personality traits that they're looking for are things like flexibility, empathy, ability to form stable and quality interpersonal relationships. That's actually one of them that they had on there. Mm-hmm. So it's 180 degrees from what it used to be, because you're stuck in this can with people that you didn't choose to be with. You're away from home. You can't go for a jog, have a bubble bath, have a drink, all the things you do to relieve stress.
Unless you're a cosmonaut, in which case they'll find a way to smuggle vodka on board.
Exactly. If you're a cosmonaut, yes, they've smuggled bottles of cognac in the sleeves of EVA suits. They've smuggled up. Someone told me they smuggled up cigarettes. That one I couldn't confirm, but yeah, they they'll bring guitars. They'll bring some astronaut brought a karaoke machine.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, which I think could go in either direction in terms of the harmony of the crew.
Right. Yeah, you could either build community among the astronauts, or you could really alienate some people in a hurry.
Yeah.
One of the things that was just so impressive to me, especially with the book Packing for Mars, is you must have had amazing access to information from not only NASA but other places too. How did you achieve that?
By banging my head against the wall for weeks on end. The access was really by wearing those people down to a stub is what I did.
Sure.
That was actually the most difficult part of this, because I was dealing with government agencies who have no real reason to say yes to me. There's nothing in it for them, and it's easier to say no, especially when you don't know what a person's going to write. And NASA is taxpayer funded. They come out of the military tradition of being a little bit wary of the media. So that was very difficult. There was a cadaver study. And I thought, okay, I've got a cadaver. I've got to work that in for my stiff reader fans.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this was being done at Ohio State University, and it was a space capsule crash test. And the people at NASA were just very uncomfortable with having me there. And I kept trying to break that down. Well, why? What is it about that? Do you want to check the facts? Do you want to read the quotes? That if I quote people, how can I make you feel okay with this? And in the end, it was just, this is death related, and we at NASA are uncomfortable with that, and we don't even want to go there. So in the end, the researcher at Ohio State, who was a contractor, said, Mary, just show up. Just show up, and mm-hmm. we'll deal with it. So I did. I showed up, and this was a very, quite a high drama morning, because the researchers were like, oh, nice to meet you. Who are you? And then, but when they found out who I was, they ran downstairs, told the graduate students who were wiring up the cadaver, don't speak to her. Ran into this office, called the public affairs office, said, Mary Roach is here. And this woman from NASA Public Affairs, who I had been going back and forth literally 3 months trying to break down, like, who can I talk to about this? Why are you saying no? They called her. Lynette Madison was her name, a lovely woman. Not her, she doesn't make the rules, but anyway, they called and said, Mary Roach is here. And Lynette said, Mary Roach is there? Oh, just talk to her.
It'll be fun.
Yeah,
really.
Fun. Yeah, really. And it's one of my favorite chapters. I don't know if it's theirs, but one of their favorite chapters, but it was a fascinating morning. But anyway, that gave them a lot of anxiety, having me there, not knowing. I guess I'm sort of perceived as a loose cannon or something. I don't know. I feel like we have the same goal, NASA Public Affairs and myself. We're getting people interested and excited about space exploration.
And I think that the book Packing for Mars does an excellent job of that. I mean, it really gives people a very realistic idea rather than the whitewashed version that we saw back in 1969 and through 70
right.
whatever. And I remember watching those space launches as a kid and thinking, oh, this is so cool and so wonderful, and then starting to think, well, wait a minute, like, what do they eat and how do they go to the bathroom and what happens if
all the things that fascinate us as human beings and the fact that you saw them in their suits kind of lumbering along toward the gantry, and they were almost larger than life. They were mythical. They weren't really human.
Right.
And that had a certain appeal for a while, but now we're not in the Apollo era anymore. It's clear these are men and women doing a job, and it's a fascinating job. So you can't really rely on the kind of mythology, larger than life stereotypes that worked very well in the 60s.
Yeah. Well, the books that you have out so far are wonderful, but you have a new book coming out called Gulp. And this one is about the alimentary canal, as I understand it, which is basically from your mouth to the far end.
Yes.
And could you quickly walk us along that path?
Well, sure. Yes, it's about all of my books are about they're people and stories and science, kind of a mishmash of that. So here, this is another book where it's people and stories and science, but everything between the mouth and, as you said, the nether, whatever you just said.
The bitter end.
The bitter end, yes, from point A to point Z. So I start out with, you know, I start out actually in the nose, which is where most of what we think of as taste. It's actually more the nose and flavor and things that we're smelling. So I spent some time with a sensory analyst, which is this woman who, she rides around on a Harley, and she's not what you think of as sort of a precious wine-tasting type of person, but she makes her living off her nose, and she's a wonderful character. Just the people that I ran into, I ran into moving along a bit toward the mouth. There's this beautiful Italian woman in the Netherlands who works in the Netherlands, Erica Saletti, and she's the world's expert on saliva. And she's, you know, she's so enthusiastic and passionate about this substance, which is quite miraculous. We don't have to go into the details of what saliva does for you, but it is pretty impressive. But she's just this wonderfully beautiful, fashionable woman who studies spit, you know, and is, you know, in this lab, like, no one comes to visit her. When I said I'd like to come to your lab, she was overcome with joy. Like, you want to talk to me about my work? Please come on down.
Why not?
Anything along this path, but, you know, once you put food in your mouth and start to chew it up, it goes from being this thing that you, you know, this wonderful, sensual thing that you lust after and dream about, it goes from being that to this object of universal disgust. And I'm trying to bring people along past the tongue and, you know, along for the ride, because it's really kind of fascinating what goes on in there. And because it's taboo, we don't give it any thought. We never think about or give any kind of respect to our guts until something goes wrong.
Right.
So here again, it's a lot of material that tends to get overlooked. And I just had a lot of fun crawling around the alimentary canal.
So anything in there about the explanation for a beer gut or diverticulitis?
A beer gut, I didn't really go into deposition of fat and why. A beer gut, well, the difference, and this I think is largely genetic, but whether you put down your fat underneath the skin or underneath the muscle depends on if you're going to have one of those high-riding guts or one of the hangy-downy kind of more loose guts. You know, you see some people have, particularly men, have a kind of a hard, high-riding belly.
Mm-hmm.
That's because the fat is under the muscle. So, and the people have the kind of the hanging down and looser, kind of gushier beer belly, that's subcutaneous fat. And how you deposit your fat, that's, I think, part of your genetic makeup. I'm not sure if there's specific foods that, I don't know if there actually is a link between beer and a particular type of beer belly, because I didn't really go into...
Locally, it would be between the Norwegians and the Finns.
Okay.
You know, the Norwegians, all the men and all the Norwegian men, their belt actually sits at about a 30-degree angle from back to front. And the Finns, their belt is straight across, but, you know, a little bigger.
There you go. It's
a genetic predisposition.
Genetic, yeah, right, exactly.
Sure.
So, and then diverticulite, the little pockets, you have diverticuli are these little, you know, if you imagine going down the tube, there are these little pockets, places along the way for material to get stuck, and sometimes bacteria can build up in there, and you can get problems with, like, diverticulitis is when you get it's material in there that's not easy for your body to kind of clean it out.
To flush it through.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I look forward to seeing this book when it comes along and and reading it. It'll be a good time. I am curious, though. I mean, you've kind of covered most bodily functions, and I was wondering what's next. And I thought perhaps maybe you were going to do some. You know, maybe the next book would be called Brain, or Feelings, or Nerves, or something like that.
Yeah, you know, I would do that, except that for. And I've given thought to those particular topics. But without a background in neuroscience, I think I would be taking on more than I could handle.
You need to get together with Candace Pert. And she was the one who wrote the Molecules of Emotion. And it's kind of a similar book, but not nearly as funny as your stuff.
Well, yeah. The other thing with those topics is the humor... It would be a little tougher.
Yeah, yeah.
The things that I gravitate to have a natural, partly because they're taboo, but partly because they're a little surreal and strange. The emotions and the brain are a little more. It's just a little straighter topics than I'm usually wandering off into. So I'm going to leave them to Candace.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for spending some time and talking to us about all things human body, gross and yucky.
And okay, sure.
I hope that everybody out there will pick up one of Mary's books. And certainly when the new one comes along, gulp, that should be very interesting. Anything else you'd like to add before we take off?
No, I'm just envious of you all living in this wonderful little community. As much as I was able to glean from the community radio website there, it sounds like a wonderful place to be, and I just envy everybody.
Yeah,
that's cool. It's really, well, literally.
Well, we do feel very lucky to be here, and it is a great place. And thank you for coming along. And you're welcome to come visit anytime. It's a great place, and lots of people come here. And it would be great if you came and. Checked it all out.
I may just take you up on that.
Okay. Yep. So, goodbye, Mary. Thank you very much, and thanks for being on the Roadhouse.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.